about a different type of classifier. We're going to be talking about decision trees. So it's a very different type of classifier from what we did previously. Previously we did naive Bayes, and remember, naive Bayes was all about probabilities. It was trying to compute the probability that the data belongs to one class versus the data belongs to another class. So it's a generative classifier. It tries to model the populations, either with Gaussians or with those Bernoulli distributions where you count how many times the word occurs in spam and ham. So decision trees, it's a very different type of classifier. It's a discriminative classifier. It tries to, I guess you can sort of think of it as generative in a way, but really what decision trees try to do, they try to split up the data so that instances of one class are on one side and instances of another class are sort of on the other side. And there isn't really a notion of a side, but it tries to pull the data apart so that instances of one class are sort of all in one group and instances of another are in another group. So I find it's quite useful to start with an example of decision trees and actually work through how they work rather than talk about what they are. So suppose I'm doing a problem like this, where I have a number of training examples and I want to build a classifier. What am I predicting? I'm trying to predict if some guy, let's say John, is going to play tennis based on the weather. So I have some observations. I've watched John for 2 weeks, and on nine days, he actually played tennis, and on 5 days, he didn't play tennis. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out how his tennis playing depends on what the weather is like, right? So on day one, it was sunny. It was highly humid. There wasn't much of a wind, and John didn't play tennis, right? And then, say on day three, it was overcast. It was quite humid. Again, there wasn't much wind, and John did play tennis. So what I want to do is I want to come up with a set of rules, with some classifier that looks like a set of rules for when John is going to play tennis and when he's not going to play tennis, right? So, and remember, we're doing learning, we're doing classification. So the ultimate goal of this is not just to interpret what John does, but if you get another day, if you get another observation, say today it's raining and it's very humid and there isn't much of a wind, so that's a lie. Today it's kind of windy. But if this was day 15, would John play tennis on that day? Right. So that's what I want to answer. I want to build a classifier that's going to look at that and predict a yes or a no. And if you just try to do it from this, you look at the set of observations, and you look at the new data point, and you see that, well, it's not exactly trivial to see whether he's going to play tennis or not. So the strategy that we're going to take is the favorite computer science strategy, divide and conquer. You can raise your hand if you know what that is. Right. Yeah, everybody knows that, right? Sorting. Okay. So this is kind of like sorting. So what I'm going to do, remember what you do in something like quicksort. You take this pile of data and you try to split it up into two sets, and then you sort of recurse on the two sets, because solving a problem on a subset of data should be easier. And if it's still not easy, you split it further and split it further, and you keep splitting until you solve the problem. So that's the idea with decision trees. With decision trees, you're going to take this set of data, you're going to split it in some way. You're going to split it into two or three subsets, and then you're going to see, is it easier to predict something like that? Can I easily predict that John will play tennis in this subset or will not play tennis, right? And if I can, if I get subsets where the entire subset John plays tennis, or the entire subset is John doesn't play tennis, if I get a pure subset like that, then I'm done. I don't get a pure subset, I just keep splitting, right? So divide and conquer. And then once I get a new data point, all I have to do is I have to figure out, well, which of the splits does it go into? And if it goes into a split that, you know, says yes, then yeah, he's going to play tennis. And if it goes into a split that says no, then no, he's not going to play tennis. So that's the idea. But how am I going to split? I'm going to split by taking a single attribute and then splitting the data based on that attribute. So I have four attributes here, like day, outlook, humidity, and wind. So let's see, could I split on play? That's a trick question. So if I split on play, would I get pure subsets? Yes, sort of by definition, because I'm looking to predict whether he's going to play it or not. So if I split on play, I'm done, right? But that's not very useful. Why is it not very useful? Yeah. You're splitting based on what you're trying to predict. So when you get a new data point, you can't split on play because you don't know what play is. So that's not a good idea. So let's try to split on outlook, right? So there is three possible values of outlook: sunny, overcast, and rain. So I'm going to split this data set into three groups. So the first is sunny. So this is all the days when it was sunny, right? Then there was overcast, and this is all the days when it was overcast. And this is rain, and this is all the days when it was raining. So what do you get? We've split our training set into three subsets, and what do we see? Yay, we actually have a pure subset, right? So it looks like if it's overcast, then John always plays. Right? We don't have any examples where it's overcast and he's not playing. So you could take, we can already take that as a rule. If it's overcast, he's gonna play regardless of the other conditions. Right, now what about the other two? So I don't have to split the overcast anymore, but the sunny and the rain, they're still a little bit mixed up. So for example, if it's not overcast, I don't know if he's going to play or not. He has two out of five chances of playing, and I want to make it a little bit more specific. So how can I do that? Well, I look for another attribute to split on. Right. So let's take this set. Now, if I split on wind, it's not clear if I'm going to get anything. But if I split on humidity, right, there seems to be a pattern, right? So I take the humidity and split just this subset, the sunny subset, based on humidity, right? So what does it look like? There's two possible values: either humidity is normal or high, and it turns out that if it's normal, there's two data points, and he played on both of those days. And if the humidity is high, there were 3 days like that, and he didn't play on any of those days. Okay? So now I have pure subsets in there. So I know that if it was sunny and the humidity was high, then John didn't play. If it was sunny and the humidity was normal, then he did play. So I have two more rules. Now, I still have to do the same procedure for the rain, so that's what I do next. I try to look for an attribute such that if I split on it, it'll give me nice and pure subsets. So, and in this case, if I split on humidity, that doesn't look very promising, but if I split on the wind, I'm getting there. So I split on the wind, there's two possible values, either weak winds or strong winds, and it looks like when the wind is weak, John always played, and when the wind was strong, John didn't play. So that's the idea. Now what happened is I have split my entire data set into these subgroups, and each subgroup is pure. Right? So I can churn these pure, yeah.
I was going to say, if you've got 2 days where the weather was actually the same, on one he played and one he didn't, you'd end up having to split on the day.
Yes. Well, so this is actually, we're going to talk about that further. So that's a very good point, very good observation, yes. Okay, so but if it turns into something like this, then what I can do at this point is I can say, well, I can forget about the data points, I can throw away the sets and just leave the rules, right? So For the cases where he played, I'm going to say yes, and for the cases where he didn't play, I'm going to say no. So now, essentially, I have some rules. If it's overcast, then he's going to play, no matter what. If it's sunny and not very humid, then he's going to play. But if it's sunny and humid, then he's not going to play. So you see, what this is doing is this is effectively encoding a set of rules that try to predict what John is going to do based on the weather attributes. So this is the idea of decision trees. Now, when you do it, you don't just have a yes. So I guess when you get a new data point, what do you do? So the new data point, I get day 15. It was raining, highly humid, and not much of a wind. Right. So I can read off the prediction for that day from the tree. Right. So I look at the top node, and I say, so what was the outlook? It was raining. So I'm in the rain, I'm in the right branch of the tree. And then humidity doesn't actually matter in this branch, but the wind does. And there was a weak wind, so he falls into this subgroup. So the prediction for John on this day would be yes, he's going to play. In addition, what I have is instead of just a yes-no, in addition to the yes-no decisions, I actually have the counts that go into each group. So what I can do is I can actually, if I am unable to split some group, so for example, if 2 days looked identical, but he played on one day and he didn't play on another day, then you would have a positive example and a negative example in the same group. Then you look at the majority, right? So for example, if you have 3 positives and 1 negative, then you would still say yes. But perhaps your confidence wouldn't be as high as if it was a completely pure group. Now, confidence is an interesting word. We're going to talk a little bit more about this later on. Confidence also has to do with how many examples went into the set, right? So if I have something like this, the overcast set, I actually have 4 examples in there. If I get a data point that's overcast, I would be much more confident about my prediction than say here or here, because here there's only 2 examples. So this is support for your prediction. It's basically saying, if it's overcast, I have 4 examples in my data where he played and none where he didn't play. So you're more confident than if you have 2 examples where he didn't play and no examples where he played.
One question.
Yeah.
The output of this tree doesn't matter and with which parameter we start with. So if you try to split it.
That comes next.
What?
Next slide. Thank you for anticipating. Okay. So if we try to take this, now this was a hand-wavy explanation. This was taking a set of data and splitting it manually. What does the algorithm look like for doing this? This is known as the ID3 algorithm, and it's due to a guy called Ross Quinlan. He invented this in 1986. So there's actually a curious precedent now. Quinlan is a computer scientist. Something very similar was done 2 years before that in statistics. It's just kind of a curious effect. But what does the algorithm look like? So if you try to encode it, the way this operates, it's an iterative algorithm. You start with a set of examples and the node of the tree. And you start with the node being the root. Right? There is no tree yet, so just take the root. So what you do with examples, you pick an attribute based on some utility measure, and we'll talk about what that measure is in the next slide. So let's say this attribute is A. Then you look at all the possible values of A, and for each one of the values, you're going to create a child node of the current node. Right. So that's what we did in the previous slide, right? So we picked outlook, and then it had 3 children, sunny, overcast, rain. And then what we do is we take our training examples and we split them up according to what the value of the attribute was. So we propagate everything that was raining into one set, overcast into another set, and sunny into the third set. And then what you do is, again, algorithmically very simple, you look at each one of the subsets, and if the subset is pure, or good enough, pure means it's all yeses or all noes, then you stop, you're done. If it's not pure, if it has a mix of positives and negatives, you recursively call the same function split on each of the impure child nodes. Right? So you pass it the node and the subset of examples that goes with that node. So it's a recursive algorithm. And as you can see, so the stopping criterion is that the set is pure. So it's going to keep splitting as long as it can. The trick, or base, all the interesting part, the non-trivial part of this, is how do you pick the attribute to split on? So I split on overcast, and it happens to work out quite well if I split on overcast. If I split on something else, it wouldn't have worked out quite as well. So how do you know which attribute to pick on? And this is a problem of assigning sort of a utility, a usefulness value to an attribute. So for example, if I take the same set of data, 9 positives, 5 negatives, I split on the outlook, and that was the result, I could have also split on the wind, right? And here's what I would get. I would get one set where the wind was weak, there would be 6 positive examples and 2 negative examples, right? So in this case, it's not a pure set, but you are pretty sure that John would play if the wind was weak without any other conditions, right? In 3 out of 4 cases, he would end up playing. But then if the wind was strong, you get a completely impure set. So 3 positive, 3 negatives, that means that I have no idea. It's 50-50. It's a toss whether he's going to play or not. Okay. So how do you decide that this is better or worse than this split? And what you want to do is you want to somehow measure the overall purity of the split. So purity in the sense that after you split the data into these subsets, am I more certain about positive and negative than before? And how much more certain am I? So in a good case, in a good split, after I split, I end up with pure subsets. So all the subsets are pure. I'm completely certain about yes or no in each one of the subsets. In a bad example, I would get all subsets that look like this. Sort of 3 yeses, 3 noes, 4 yeses, 5 noes. So I want to have some sort of a function that measures this certainty associated with each one of the splits. And then I want to somehow aggregate it over the different subsets that I get from using this attribute. Note that you can't do something as simple as sort of the probability of a yes, right? So, and the simplest reason why you can't is it has to be symmetric, right? So if I have 4 yeses and 0 noes, that's just as good as 0 yeses and 4 noes, right? What I care about is the separation, not the probability of a positive in this case. So it has to be some sort of a symmetric function. A function that's actually used in the ID3 algorithm is based on entropy. Right? So we're going to have a little bit of a very brief introduction to an entropy. So an entropy is one way to measure purity of a set with respect to some yes and no labels. You can also think you can think of entropy as a measure of information about what the subset contains. So not really information, but entropy is a measure of uncertainty, right? So if you have a high entropy subset, that means you're really not sure what labels are in the subset. So if you reach into the subset and pull out a random label, you wouldn't be able to predict if it's a yes or no. That's a high entropy subset. If the subset has low entropy, that means I'm completely certain that I'm going to reach in and pull out a no. So the equation for the entropy is sort of P plus log P plus minus P minus log P minus. What is P plus and P minus? P plus is the proportion of the positive examples in the subset, and P minus is the proportion of the negative examples. Right. So if so here are some examples. If I had a subset which had 3 yeses and 3 noes, right? So this is as impure as it gets. There is a 50-50 chance. I'm completely uncertain if it's going to be a yes or no. So what does the entropy work out to in this way? So the P positive is 3 out of 6, because there are 6 total items in the data set. So I have 3-6 log 2, 3-6, minus 3-6 log 2, 3-6, because for the negatives, it's actually the same probability as the positive in this case. So, and this is this particular case is easy to do by hand. You don't need a calculator for this, right? Because this is just 1/2, and log base 2 of 1/2 is just minus 1, right? So I have minus 1 multiplied by minus here, so this is going to be a 1, multiplied by 1/2. So this whole thing is going to be 1/2, and then the second thing is 1/2 as well. So 1/2 plus 1/2 is 1. If I take a completely pure set, then this is what I get. So I get 1 log 1 minus 0 log 0. So 1 log 1, that's easy. That's 0. Log of 1 is a 0. This one is a little bit non-trivial. You have 0 log 0, and log 0 is undefined. But if you remember L'Hopital's rule, then 0 actually overrules the 0 under the log. So this is a 0 as well. So in this case, you have a 0 plus 0, so 0. If you plot the entropy as a function of P positive, as the function of this P plus, that's what it looks like. Right. So in this case, on this end, so here P plus is 0, this means that the set is entirely negative. Right. So in this case, I'm completely sure about the contents. I know they're all negative, and the entropy is 0. You have the same thing on the opposite end. If the set is entirely positive examples, P plus is 1 and the entropy is 0. In the middle, where you have P plus at 1/2, half the examples are positive, half the examples are negative. This is as uncertain as it gets. So the entropy has the highest possible value of 1. Now, the entropy is measured in bits, and one way to interpret the entropy is it's basically, if you know that the item is in the set, how many bits on average would you need to tell me if it's positive or negative? And if I know that the set is pure, I don't need any bits, so the entropy is 0. If the set is completely random, completely impure, then for each item, I need a bit. I need something that tells me yes or no, 0 or 1. If the set is mostly yeses but has a little bit of noes, then on average, I don't need a full bit. I need a little bit less than that. So that's what the entropy is trying to capture. Now, this is a measure for one set. So I took this overcast, I split it into three sets. Entropy tells you for one set how pure or impure the set is. The next thing I need to do is I need to somehow aggregate it across the three subsets. And here you get, the measure that Quinlan used is called information gain. In statistics, it's also known as the mutual information between two random variables. So an interpretation for the information gain is you're going to look at the purity before the split and after the split, and see how much more pure it got, or how much uncertainty you have removed by splitting on these attributes. So this is the formula, and if we go through this, H of S, S is the set of items at the current node before we split. V are possible values of a certain attribute A. S of V, this is the set or the subset of S that has value V for the attribute A. Right. So what is this doing? This is the entropy that I had before the split. Right. Before I split, I have the set, and I measure how uncertain am I about the yeses and noes in the set. And after I split, the way to interpret this formula is sort of this. I have a number of subsets, right, as many as the different values of the attribute. Each subset has a certain purity level. That's H of SV, the entropy of that subset. But then look at what I'm doing here. I'm multiplying it by something. What am I multiplying it by? I'm multiplying it by the size of that subset. Right? So this is the size of the subset, and this is the size of the original set. Right? So this is like the proportion of items that go into subset SV. Why am I doing this? The reason I'm doing this is I want, ideally, what I want is I want the pure subsets to be as big as possible. So if I have lots of items that went into a pure subset, it's good. If I have a pure subset, perfectly pure, but it has only one item, that's not very useful. So that's what I want. I want lots of items going into pure subsets and few items going into impure subsets. So that's the interpretation of the formula. So if we take an example, so suppose we take our data and split on the wind, right? Again, let's just work through it. Before we split, we have 9 positives and 5 negatives. So the entropy, the impurity of the set is 0.94, and the way you compute it is 9/14th log 9/14th minus 5/14th log 5/14th. So that's just our definition of the entropy. Now, I split it on the wind. 8 of them are going to be weak. 6 of them are going to be strong wind. In the weak subset, I have 6 positives, 2 negatives. The impurity, the entropy of that is 0.81, right? And in the strong subset, what's going to be the entropy? 1. Okay, so that should be a knee-jerk reaction now. So if you have a 50-50 split, the entropy is 1. It's the highest possible value. So now what I need to do is I need to take this original entropy and the entropy in the subsets and combine them all. And the way I do that is really trivial. I take the original entropy, 0.94, and subtract from it the 2 entropies in the 2 subsets, weighted by how big the subsets are. Right? So this has an entropy of 1, this has an entropy of 0.81, but this one is bigger. This has 8 out of 14 items, and this has 6 out of 14 items. So that they act as weights for those entropy numbers. And if I do that, then I get a reduction in entropy. So 0.049, this is how much more certain I am about the labels after I do this particular split. And now, if I'm an algorithm and I'm building a decision tree, what I need to do is I remember this number, 0.049, for the wind. Now I need to take overcast and repeat the whole calculation for the overcast. I get another number, and then I take the humidity, repeat the whole calculation, I get a third number, and then I look at which of those 3 numbers is the biggest. So that tells me which attribute reduces the uncertainty the most.
Yeah. It would still be correct if you ignore the entropy of the original subset, right? Because you're comparing the numbers to each other.
Exactly. So if you, when you're comparing the numbers, you could actually ignore this number altogether because it's a constant. It's the same for all attributes. You don't need to compute it. In fact, there's lots of, I don't know if we're going to have time for this or not, but there's lots of little things that you can cancel out from this equation. It turns out that you need to include many fewer numbers than is on the page. So maybe we'll do it at a later point. Okay, but this is how you compute the gain. And then you can use the gain to tell you which attribute to use to split. And then you keep going. There was a question, yes?
Yes, we expand the calculation of gain there. There are 2 terms that have S sub weak. Is that shouldn't be a term for strong, another for weak, at the bottom left?
Oh, yeah, okay, so thank you. So this should be strong. Okay, so now if you think about decision trees, something you will realize pretty soon. Unless the data has repeated observations with different labels, a decision tree will always find a way to split it perfectly. Right? Why is that? because it never stops. It's going to keep splitting and splitting and splitting until it's going to end up with singleton nodes, right? So at the bottom of the tree, if sets are impure, you will get a singleton. And a singleton is by definition pure because there's only one value there. Now, if you have 2 days, so if day is not an attribute, and you have two examples which have identical representation, but one is a yes and one is a no, then obviously you can't split them. But that's an extreme case. For data that doesn't have repetitions of observation, the decision tree will always find a way to split it perfectly. So does that mean that you can build a classifier that's 100% accurate? And here we get into an interesting issue. Yes and no. If you're talking about the training examples, the data that you gave the classifier for training, then yes, it's going to build a classifier that's 100% accurate. And it's guaranteed to do that. Now, but the more interesting thing for us is, what is it going to do when you give it new data, data that it hasn't seen before? And what it turns out is, when you give it new data, a perfect classifier, a classifier that works really, really well on the training data, isn't going to do terribly well on the testing data. So this is a typical example of what's happening. What you have on the x-axis is the size of the tree. That's how many nodes you have in the tree, right? So if you imagine sort of the more nodes you have, the closer you are to splitting all the data into singletons. And what you have on the y-axis is the accuracy of the classifier on two different data sets. The solid line is the training data, and the dotted line, the dashed line, is the testing data. That's the data that it hasn't seen before. And what you see is kind of an interesting picture. Now, for the training data, not surprisingly, the more nodes you include, so by the way, how do you include less nodes? You just stop early. So instead of growing the tree all the way down, after I have, say, 20 nodes, I decide that I'm going to stop at this point and then see how well it does. Now, on the training data, the deeper you grow the tree, the better it's going to do. Why? Because it's splitting the data better and better and better in a more fine-grained way. Now, for the testing data, the accuracy grows up until a certain point, but then it actually starts decreasing. So what is happening is, we haven't talked about this yet, but what's happening is the classifier is overfitting to the training data. So initially, the accuracy was growing. That means that it was finding useful ways to split the data, ways that reflected the training data, but also the testing data, which the classifier hasn't seen before. But after a certain point, the splits became too specific to the training data. So basically, it will always find a way to split them, and it was splitting them in nonsensical ways, in ways that have nothing to do with positives and negatives. And that's why when you give it the testing data, the accuracy is actually lower than if you had a fewer number of nodes in the tree, right? So this is a classical problem of overfitting. So what do you do about this? And in decision trees, you have specific strategies for battling overfitting. The way to not overfit is, you can basically get it from this slide. The way to not overfit is to stop somewhere around here, right? Is to stop when the training accuracy is good, but also the testing accuracy is maximum. So, yeah.
Is this graph independent of the size of your initial training set?
This graph is one particular example, and you shouldn't actually draw any conclusions about the values. In general, things will look like that. But this maximum point, don't assume that it's going to be around 10 or 20. For your data set, it might be around 2,000, or it might be around 2. So everything depends. When you move to a new data set, everything changes. Okay, so the way to avoid overfitting is to stop early to end up with a tree that's not grow the tree to its full size. And there's two ways you can do that. So one, you could stop growing early, right? Now, how would you decide when to stop? Because when you're looking at the training data, sort of the more you split, the better the accuracy is going to get. So one way to do that is to look at statistical significance of the split, right? So if you were splitting, if you did a split and you end up having sort of 90 positives and 10 negatives, that's probably a useful split. If you split and you end up having 2 positives and 1 negative, it's unclear it was worth splitting. So that difference could easily be due to chance. So you could try to come up with a strategy that looks at statistical significance of the splits. It turns out that something that works better empirically is post-pruning. So in this strategy, what you do is you build you build a full tree. So you build it all the way to the end until it splits the training data perfectly. And then what you do is you take another set of data that the classifier hasn't seen before. That's called a validation set. So it's this data must be different from the training set, otherwise it's not going to work. So you take this validation set and you start trying to randomly remove nodes from the tree. So randomly remove nodes. Let me just try to give an example where we have a tree. Okay, so this would be a full tree that I got from the training data. It splits the training data perfectly. So what I would do is I would say, suppose I remove this node entirely. Suppose I remove the split on wind. What's going to happen? Now, I know what's going to happen on the training data. On the training data, this is still going to be perfectly classified. This is going to be perfectly classified. This is going to be perfectly classified. But this subset will now be imperfectly classified. If I remove this node, I take the majority vote. So in the rain, I would say it's yes, because there is more positives than negatives. So this means that on two negatives that fall into this data, I would actually make a mistake. So my error rate would be 2 out of 14 if I removed this node. If I removed this node, what would be my error? So who thinks it's 3 out of 14? Okay, who thinks it's 2 out of 14?
Okay, good. So it's about 50-50.
It's 2 out of 14, and the reason for that is this node, if I removed the split on humidity, it would get classified as a no, right? Because there's 3 negative examples, 2 positive examples. So I would say if the outlook is sunny, John is not going to play. And this would make mistakes on two examples out of 14. So this is how you compute an error. This is on the training set. Now, what you do instead is you compute the same error on the validation set, on the set of data that the algorithm hasn't seen before. And you try removing every single node from the tree, and then you look at the one that gave you the biggest improvement. And because we're dealing with a validation set, in the training data, whenever you remove a node, the accuracy is going to get worse. But in the validation set, when you remove a node, accuracy is actually going to go up, right? Why is it going to go up? Well, because you are basically, you're starting here with a full tree, and then you're removing nodes. So you're trying that way. The accuracy will improve a little bit. So what you do is you go over the entire tree, and you find a node such that if you cut it, it improves your accuracy by as much as possible. Right? Then you get a new tree, and then you repeat the procedure. You try to cut another node using this validation set again, and you stop when you can't make it any better. Yes?
Does this mean the validation data has to be like considerably bigger than the training data?
Okay, so we're going to. The question is whether the validation data set has to be bigger than the training data set. The short answer is no. The long answer is we're actually going to have a lecture that talks about splits and sort of training data and validation data. Typically, the validation, well, I guess. They're about this.
The same, be smaller.
Yeah. So it really kind of depends on the classifier that you're building, and I don't have a good intuition for decision trees. So as Charles said, in many classifiers, it's actually much smaller. The training set is bigger than the validation set.
What are you trying to learn the validation set here? It's one number, right? When do I stop proving? So like, what's like a minimum information gain for when I should stop proving? So what am I trying to learn with the training set? It's a whole tree. So I'm trying to get a lot more information out of the training set than I am from the validation set. But there's no, it's all a black.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's no theory behind that. All right, so you keep doing that as long as your accuracy keeps increasing and then you stop. Okay, so now if we sort of pause and recap, we were talking about decision trees. So the task that they're trying to do, we're trying to do classification. It's a discriminative classifier. It's not trying to model the data. It's trying to split it apart into positives and negatives. The model structure is a tree. The score function is kind of interesting. At each node in the tree, you have a very specific objective function. You're maximizing the information gain, but that's locally at every node. If you try to figure out what is the objective function globally, there isn't a very clear thing that you could say about this. The things you could say, the algorithm is biased. It likes to have short trees, and it likes to have high gain attributes at the root. That's really the only way you can characterize it. And the search method is a greedy search with information gain as the objective function. Okay, now, so there's a couple of things you need to know about information gain. One is it has an inbuilt bias towards attributes that result in many subsets. So for example, in our case, I never tried to split on the day. If I did that, if I split on the day, it would stop right there and then, right? Because I have 14 different days, so there's 14 possible values of that attribute. Each of those subsets is a singleton. It only has one example, and each of them is perfectly pure because it's either a yes or a no. So that if the algorithm picked day, it would stop right there and then, and it would declare an answer. And the bad thing about this is you can't actually fix it by post-pruning. Because if you try to do this pruning thing to reduce, so this is a classic example of overfitting. It's basically saying, you know, what does this tree mean as far as rules? As far as rules, it means if it's day one, then it's a no. If it's day two, then it's a no. If it's day three, then it's a yes. So it's overfit to the data. There is no way to correct for this overfitting, because if you try to post-prune this, there is nothing to prune. So that's something that you should be aware of. If one of your attributes is sequential, or if you have an attribute that uniquely identifies each data instance, decision tree is going to have a hard time with that. And it won't really do very well for new data, right? So if you have day 15, what do you do? So one solution to that is to use gain ratio instead of just gain. And the idea there is you take the gain and you normalize it by sort of the split size. So the split entropy, that's one way to measure the size of the split. It's just the entropy of the split, but not of the labels. It's just the entropy over the counts. So if you have lots of small cells, then this is going to be a large number. So you're going to take the gain and divide by the large number, and that's going to make it smaller. So this is the way to try to encourage your ID3 algorithm to not make a mistake like that. A good thing about trees is this is perhaps the only example of an interpretable classifier, fully interpretable. So once you've learned a tree, you can just read off rules for what makes something positive and what makes something negative. And these rules are short, and they're also sort of interpretable by humans. So in this case, I know that for predicting whether John is going to play or not, either it's overcast, or it's raining and there's not much of a wind, or it's sunny and it's not very humid. Right? So that's a rule. It's like a logical formula. you can take it to somebody like a doctor, and they will say, ah, okay, this makes sense. Almost all the classifiers that we're going to be talking from the next lecture, they don't have this property. They can separate the data, but they don't produce anything that you could take to a client and say, this is what's happening in the data. This is why that is positive and that is negative, right? So they're not interpretable. Decision trees are interpretable, and this is it's a major advantage. They're not a black box to your clients. So decision trees, the example that I ran, it was on discrete data. We had categorical attributes. You can build decision trees on continuous attributes. And the way you do that is you, well, you basically reduce it to the problem that you know how to solve. You take a continuous attribute and you turn it into discrete. And how do you turn a continuous attribute into something that's discrete? You find a threshold. So you find a certain threshold, and if the number is smaller than the threshold, it's sort of smaller, and then if it's larger, then it's larger, so now you have two possible values, smaller and larger. So once you've done that, the algorithm runs in exactly the same way. The only difference, of course, is you want to know how to pick a threshold. Sometimes you might have some intuition from the domain knowledge on how to pick a threshold. If you don't, then there's actually an algorithm for optimizing the threshold position. It optimizes the threshold position in the same way so as to optimize the gain. Yeah. It's really fairly straightforward, so it's in the textbook. The example that I gave, this was binary. It's fairly easy to extend it to multi-class. The only thing that you need to change is your entropy gets a few more terms because you don't have just positives and negatives, you now have several classes. And then, so this P of C is the proportion of samples that fall into a particular class. You can use decision trees for regression. Regression is predicting a number, right? So how do you do that? The simplest way is you build a tree, and then for each leaf node, you average the numbers, the training numbers in that tree, and then that average becomes the prediction for that subset. And then when a new testing data comes in, you push it down the tree, you see which subset it ends up in, and you take the average to be the prediction. So it's really fairly simple. This is a lot more advanced. If you wanted to, you could actually inside do linear regression. And in a few lectures, Charles is going to talk about how you run linear regression. This would end up doing sort of a population of regressors. Okay, and I think we'll just pick it up on the next lecture. So, thanks.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not. 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 but it is something
oh, I get it. It breaks. No, I think it's pretty good. It would be better on this one. You're going to sit down.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's go.
So the original algorithm will basically you could imagine them doing something like a search that's more than one step or something that's a little bit set. So I guess in practice, so the thing that I didn't cover, that's the best, that's a better way to.
Yeah, so what we were doing quarterly was, like we said, for each class,
I'm going to talk about one modification in the next lecture. So that's where we get an ensemble. And that actually turns out to work really well. There is also lots of improvement. So there's little tricks that make it a little bit better.